Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Samantha Larson, science writer at Washington Sea Grant, and your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Today, I'm out at the National Motor Lifeboat School along with Coastal Cafe co-host Aaron Barnett. This school is a Coast Guard training center located at Cape Disappointment in Awako, Washington, at the mouth of the Columbia River. The school trains its students who come from across the country for about a month at a time to become what are known as surfmen, the people who risk their lives by going out in motor lifeboats in high seas and stormy weather to conduct search and rescue missions. The Columbia River Bar is notorious for its strong tides and currents. Despite these inherent dangers, fishing boats and other vessels frequently cross the area as they head out and back from the port of Astoria. This combination of high maritime activity and frequently treacherous seas has earned the Columbia River Bar its nickname, the Graveyard of the Pacific. The U.S. Coast Guard station at Cape Disappointment, which is right next to the Motor Lifeboat School, stays very busy, conducting an average of about 500 search and rescue missions per year. But safely conducting these kinds of search and rescue missions requires a lot of practice on stormy seas. In the winter, the waves at the Columbia River Bar can tower as high as 40 feet, providing the perfect training grounds for the National Motor Lifeboat School's most advanced students. We're here at the Motor Lifeboat School in Awako, Washington. I'm here with Chief Sadler. What is a motor lifeboat?
Motor lifeboat is the primary search and rescue asset for a lot of the small boat units up and down the east and west coast. 47 foot long, it's one of the most capable platforms we have for search and rescue. Capabilities of that boat are 50 knots of wind, 20 foot breaking surf, and 30 foot seas.
I think these boats are famous for their ability to, if they capsize, they'll turn back over. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why they have that capability?
So there's a common misconception, and we get that a lot. We get asked all the time, like, oh, do you go out there and roll those boats over on purpose? And they are designed to roll over, and they'll rewrite themselves within 12 seconds, but we don't ever go out there and intentionally roll them over. That's typically something's gone wrong from the boat driving aspect when those boats do end up capsizing. So far, they've all returned upright, and we've been able to get them all safely out of the surf.
So what are these boats used for? When and where and how often are they deployed?
So they're up and down the East Coast and the West Coast. Most of the 47s are utilized to the fullest capabilities in the Pacific Northwest. That's where most of our surf units are located. And all those surf units are typically located on like a small river bar, or in this case, a large river bar, the Columbia River where we're at now. And where those rivers meet the ocean, that's where you typically see really rough seas. Commercial boats have to transit those bars to go out and perform, you know, their job as fishermen. And that's where a lot of people find themselves in trouble. So not only do we need to cross those bars to get out there and help people that are in distress, but on the bars themselves, we see a lot of SAR cases happen.
And SAR being search and rescue.
Search and rescue, yeah. Exactly.
So here in Awako, we're at the mouth of the Columbia River, and this area is known as the Graveyard of the Pacific. Can you talk a little bit about what makes this area unique and why this is a good place to have a motor lifeboat school?
That's exactly right. So it was in the 60s was when they started utilizing this place, the Columbia River Bar, specifically as a training facility, right, or as a training location. They started bringing people from around the local area, and now we have what is now the National Motor Lifeboat School, where we host Mexican Navy officers, we host Canadian Coast Guard. They come here to train. And you have the Columbia River that's fed from three states in the United States, and there's actually rivers that originate up in Canada. So all of that water is fed into the Columbia River, and that river hits the Pacific Ocean head on, causing some of the roughest conditions you'll see anywhere in the world.
So is this the only school of its kind?
It is. This school is very unique. For small boat operations, this is, you know, in the grand scheme of the world, this is very unique. There's no other place like it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this school? What are people learning here? What kind of credentials do people get by coming to this school?
Yeah, so there's three schools that we host here, three classes, I should say. And in the summer months, we hold like a basic operator class, and we're in the process of revising that. But currently, we have them out for 2 weeks. We'll have basic coxswains that we're trying to train. They'll come out here for 2 weeks, and we're just teaching basic boat operations, right? It's a chance for the students to be removed from their typical duty standing at their home units, and they come out here for 2 weeks straight. We're just teaching them how to operate the boat in basic calm conditions. And we're shooting for less than 10-foot seas, less than 20 knots of wind, and that's our basic class. And we'll put quite a few students through that class in the summer months. And then looking into fall and early spring, we're hosting a heavy weather class. And we'll put 48 students through that heavy weather class each year. And that's typically broken into four different classes. And we'll have those students out for 3 weeks to a month, depending on the weather conditions, right? If we don't have enough weather, we might have them here for a month so that we can maximize those training conditions. And that's a more challenging qualification. What we're looking for there is we're looking for 15-foot seas, we're looking for 30, 40 knots of wind, and we're out there, we're training, we're doing man overboard drills, we're doing towing drills, and we're teaching them how to operate that boat in really, really rough seas. And that's where they'll get their first taste, as far as in a training sense, into entering the surf zone. We will try and get them over there and get them exposed to 8, 10-foot breaks so that they can get a feel for that. And then right now what we have in session is the surf class. And that surf class is our most elite class. And we have 12 students right now from all around the Coast Guard that are here to train primarily in surf. And we'll have them here for a month. And our whole goal, every day that we have it, we're going to be out there trying to find the biggest surf, keeping it less than the limitations of the boat, right? Less than 20 foot. But we're out there trying to put them in the most challenging surf conditions we can find.
After this training and other training, they'll be classified as a surfman. Is that correct?
Yeah, so to speak on how that qualification process works, here they're getting the training, they're getting experience and exposure to these very, very difficult situations as far as from a boat operator aspect. They're going to need to go back to their home units, and they'll fill out a personal qualification standard or a PQS. And with that, you know, they got a lot of things that they have to hit. They have to check the box satisfactory for man overboard drills, inbounds, outbounds, laterals. There's a handful of things they have to complete and have signed off by the command. One of the hardest things that you can't really put on paper is that judgment and maturity. That's something that the command has to have full faith in that member, that they are mature and that they can handle themselves and, most importantly, manage their crew, right, in those life or death situations. And that's the hardest part. That's something you can't really teach in a classroom. They just have to have that experience and that mentorship to develop that.
So in broad strokes, what is a surfman? It's being a captain of a motor lifeboat, or?
That's right. It's so it's the most elite certification you can have as a small boat operator. And it's still, you know, your role is still that of a coxswain. But that surfman pin or that surfman title means that you can operate that boat up to the fullest limitations of that platform. Yep. And we have here we're primarily training on the 47-foot motor lifeboat, but there also are four 52-foot motor lifeboats that are in service, and that's an additional qual that a surfman can pursue if they're at one of those units.
Four boats that are in service here.
So we don't have a 52 here at the National Lifeboat School, but Cape Disappointment right next door, they do have a 52-foot motor lifeboat, and it has like a slightly higher capability. So it can handle, I think, up to 25-foot breaking surf, higher winds, higher seas, and it has a lot longer range too. So that's the platform that they're going to use. If they have boats broke down 75-plus miles out, the 47 might not be able to respond to those cases. That's when the 52 would take over. Yeah.
So you mentioned that there are motor lifeboats up and down the east and west coast. How many people are certified surfmen out there?
So it's hard to put that number. I don't have that exact number, but typically you're running around 100 or less people that are actively serving in that surfman capacity.
But there's like a 75% attrition rate?
Yes. Yeah, so the failure rate's rather high. Most people that show up and say, hey, I want to be a surfman, a significant majority of those people aren't going to be able to see that certification all the way through. And there's a lot of challenges in place there. First of all, you have to have that ability, right, to pick up all the boat operating skills that are needed. Another big thing that kind of catches people off guard is that the surfman community is rather small. And typically it takes 5 to 7 years to certify as a surfman, historically speaking, and we've got things in place to trim that time down. But 5 to 7 years it takes, and that's a lot of commitment, right? 5 to 7 years, a lot of people wash out just because it's such a long, grueling process. And once you do certify, there's a good chance you're going to spend a majority of your career, if not the rest of your career, at surf units. And we talked about there's only 19 search and rescue units, so your options are very limited. And often those locations are on small coastal towns, population of 8,000 or less, 2 hours from the nearest Walmart. And it catches a lot of families off guard, right, knowing that they're bottlenecked into such a small community. And, you know, a lot of people realize that and you know, we'll bow out of that qualification.
So what's the history of the school here? How did this come to be?
So the school actually was in the mid-1960s was when the school sort of got its start. And it was they gathered people from local areas to come out and train on the treacherous Columbia River Bar. And it wasn't officially stood up as a training center until the early 1970s. I believe it was 1972. Master Chief McAdams was assigned to stand this place up as an actual training center.
How far back does the tradition of the surfman go, and where did that start?
So the Revenue Cutter Service merged with the Life Saving Service. That was in 1915 when they merged, and that's sort of the original origin of the actual Coast Guard, right? The modern Coast Guard that you see today. Yeah, and then something special about the surfman qualification. Once you earn that qualification of surfman, you're assigned a number, and up to this point, and this is backdated, there's only 557 certified surfmen in the history of the Coast Guard. And all of that's maintained here. The registry of the surfmen are all kept in-house, like everything's kept track of here at the National Motor Lifeboat School.
So we're actually going to go out on the boats today.
That's the plan, absolutely. Yeah, we're here on a good day. We've got the buoys are up. We're looking at 14, 15-foot swell at a 15-second period. Out of the west, so we're going to be out there training in Clatsop Spit. It's on the southern end of the Columbia River Bar. Students have been progressing nicely. We're in the third week of training, and the goal today is to run some more inbounds, outbounds. So a lot of challenges with that. We're going to push out to 10 range, one of our outer training zones, where we're going to see larger breaks, and we're going to challenge those students to actually turn the boat around, run about a mile inbound, and square back up. So we're exposing our stern to the seas, and we'll be negotiating some larger breaks. So it's a good day for the students.
What do you mean by inbounds, outbounds?
Right, so outbound, so we'll transit into the surf, and in that case, we're simulating like we need to exit the surf. We need to push out through the surf to either exit or get out there where there might be a person in the water. So they're going to try and transit and negotiate the swells and the breaks to get from point A to point B as fast as possible while keeping the crew safe. And then once we're out there, it's very dangerous to transition from one position to run inbound because you have to flip the boat all the way around with brakes rolling in. There's going to be a lot of timing, a lot of judgment. It's going to be very challenging for the students. It's going to be a fun day.
All right, I'm looking forward to it. For the students, the morning began with an overview of the plan for the day and an assessment of the risks that would be involved.
So for both of you, this is our general assessment of risk. This is what we're going to be doing, our risk versus our gain. We're going to be going through each category. You're going to see a lot of ones, twos, and threes. That's just going to be a designation of whether or not they're a low, medium, or high risk for each category. Medium risk, high gain. Accept the mission with command endorsement. Communicate risk versus gain to chain of command. Implement controls and monitor risk factors. Continuously evaluate conditions and mission change. Everyone good with high risk, medium gain? Senior, do you have anything to add?
No, the zone should be really good. It's probably the most that you probably haven't seen it. We're on the incoming tide. It's a traditional Clatsop Spit type of zone. So it should be very productive for inbounds and outbounds. You know, just remember the things that you've been taught to this point. You've done a bunch of inbounds and outbounds so far as through the process of it all, right? Nothing's going to be really different. We're in the middle of week three. So, like, do what you do and have fun. Be safe, right? Communicate well. 5 boats in there. But I'll be back. So.
Something I think should be addressed. Sorry, Kenny. You guys haven't really seen Death Row or Clash to Pit like we're saying. So even as instructors, we talk about it. We get down to Benson and we feel great, right? Like, we got Clash It. Just don't let it tricky. Don't get lulled to sleep. Do not be complacent just because it's classic. Death row is no joke.
If you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I'm Samantha Larson, today's host of Coastal Cafe. And we're at the United States Coast Guard's Motor Lifeboat School at Ilwaco, Washington. From the classroom, we suited up in bright orange Mustang suits, which are insulated for warmth and waterproof to protect against both the rain and the waves as many of them surge overboard. Then we met on the boats. There were about six of us on each of the three boats that went out that day. Before we got underway, one of the instructors briefed us on some more of what to expect for the day.
We may not, I don't know. So, today is going to be super important that we wait for the series. Usually in Clatsop, like, it'll be breaking and there'll be a series. And we're like, yeah, go. We'll figure it out and pick it apart as we're going through. Not today, okay? At least for that death row part. Once we get through death row, that mentality may change a little bit. We may have you guys transit lateral or outbound during series and whatnot. But for that death row section especially, make sure we wait for the last one of the series before you guys go through. The bridge is going through that from south to north through death row. Unless we see a great opportunity to get through death row and the lull, we'll probably square up and wait, all right, on the inside of death row, just south of it. And we'll make sure that we're good on our range and that we wait for that series before we transit through death row.
Okay, we are underway. It's calm so far. It's a little bit windy, but I hear it's going to be a bigger surf today than they've had in the last couple of weeks. I guess it's a long period, which means that the waves won't be as frequent, but they'll be more powerful. So this will be interesting. It was a bit of a rush just getting ready, putting on all the gear. I'm pretty warm right now. I'm definitely sweating in my suit, but I hear that's going to change pretty soon. So let's see what happens.
Off the backside and kind of hurt your crew or damage the boat.
Yeah. So from my perspective, these waves seem really big, and I just got a little seasick. From your perspective, how does this compare to like normal training days?
This is generally a good training day. 12 to 14 is what we're seeing out here right now. It may pick up here once the flood starts coming in, and the wave speed's going to pick up a little bit as well. But for training, this is actually great training because these are second generation breakers, which, you know, they're breaking way out there past the 10 range, coming inside, and we're getting not as much energy on them, so it's a lot easier to navigate them, so it's better for us, but it's a perfect training day.
Yeah.
But ideally, this has been the upper end of the days that we've trained, so this is one of the bigger days, which is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at a 16-foot buoy at 16 seconds. That's awesome training weather for out here in Clatsop on a second-generation day.
Yeah.
If you're offshore, on the first generations, might be a little too big for us.
Coming up on range.
Turn it on already?
Okay.
One of the things here we use too is we have a GoPro that monitors both our hand throttle movement and our rudder angle indicator.
The rudder angle indicator?
So it's telling us where our rudders are, whether midship, full to starboard, full to port. Because that affects, you know, which way we're going. It could affect you, like if you're launching off the backside of a wave, it can help scrub momentum going that way. So we kind of use that. So as we're getting square on a wave that's coming at us, we might not see it while we're in the zone training, but we can go back and pull footage from the GoPro to see and help correct those mistakes. Because when you're taking a swell or a break right on the bow, you want to be everything square. A little bit of momentum into it, square, and then back down as you're going down, so it gives it that nice slide down the backside. which helps prevent from launching, which is what we don't want to do, but sometimes, as you felt earlier, it happens.
Yeah,
that's usually going to happen on your first run, because we don't know how much energy or momentum we need to have going into these slows. So as soon as the day progresses, you figure that out. You know, like, they're not carrying as much momentum as they would on a beach surf, because this is a bar surf, or bar breaks, so they, you know, the different type of energy wave breaking on you. We're on a beach, like where we trained 2 days ago, Benson Beach. Those were all first generation breaks, so they haven't lost any of their energy in them. Where these ones have already broken offshore, came in, so they don't have as much energy. What he's doing right now is he's trying to just, he's weaving his way through the zone. He's looking for the dark side corners. Right here, like we have one right off the beam, but we're going to get at that one. So he's looking for either near side shoulders or far side shoulders, trying to navigate using as well, while trying to stay on range. Well, as you can see, the swell passing in front of us. We don't want to be on the beam one when it breaks. That's going to send us for a ride, and that's not a fun thing. So he's using his rudder, slowing us down. It's like a giant barn door behind you. The more you turn it, the more it slows you down, right? And all that water is getting displaced by it. And he's using his engine to throttle power to try to either beat a swell or slow down to catch the near side of the swell, just like he did right here. If you ever find yourself, like, cruising at, like, 1,000 RPMs, 800 RPMs, our turbos don't work at that speed, so we kind of lost all of that. You normally will just square up and then reevaluate. Take a break or two off the bow and then lateral again to get that momentum back up. You know, I square up right now because it's breaking all off of our port side right there, so that's why we just square up right here. This is a safe area.
Okay. Yeah, it's okay here.
Alright, and we are on inside range, so he's probably going to push up a little bit, right? And then we'll evaluate kind of where we're looking. We're looking for a series. We don't want to head outbound on a series, right? Because that's just, you're driving straight into a wall of water. We don't want to do that. So what he's going to do is time it. So you've got a break on the bow. You might want to cover it up.
Okay.
Yep, don't want to get away. Yeah, like, oh, dude. Use the dry suit. So timing right now is we want to be on the backside of a series. So kind of in the lull spot is where you want to do. So that's the calm. So a lull is when there's like a series of swells that just came through and it's kind of like a nice calm area. That's the best time to shoot outbound because you get the most speed and cover the most ground and not really run into any big swells that are going to do any danger to you. So that's what he's doing right now. He's timing the swells. We have a couple swells coming in and probably right when he sees his window to go, he's going to pull ahead and shoot outbound.
Okay.
Ideally, this is where you'll be during a man overboard or a person in the water. You'll be down swell of them, right? And then you'll time the series just like we're doing. Wait for a nice calm period. See how it's kind of calm out there right now?
Yeah.
And then you'll make your approach, go up on them, and try to recover them before that next series comes in and picks you up. Because you don't want to cover up a person in the water on a series because it's bad. For one, you have your crew down in the recess down here, clipped in, taking breaks like right on them. And two, you don't want to have that swell pick that person in the water up and slam them into your bow.
Yeah. Looks good. Still clear.
No sand.
Hey, on range.
So, yeah. So for a stern lookout, a lot of focus is forward of us because there's a lot of energy shooting at us. But another lookout important part is on the stern. Because as we get past into that shallow water like we talked about earlier, you can start to see sand kick up. If a wave looks darker than any other side or lighter, and an indication of maybe sand. Roger. Indication of maybe sand, and we're getting too far pushed in on range where we don't want to be. So, as you can see, a lot of the people are calling forward lookouts, like a little break on the bows. But you don't want to focus too much on that.
Yeah.
That's why a stern lookout back here is Roger. So now we're pushing out. So he found his lull and his, we found his window where we can kind of just go on a nice lull.
Yeah.
Where we're not going to be sending us and launching us off waves again. And now it's just navigating safely out, trying to find the shoulders of each swell. Because you don't want to take a swell in right when it's breaking.
Yeah.
You want to find the shoulders on the sides of them because it's nice and soft. You just kind of glide right over like we're doing right here.
Yeah, we're kind of like curving around the waves.
It's a lot of work for the pilots, a lot of seeing into the future. You kind of have to look out and navigate. So if you see a bunch of swells building up on this side, well, you need to start working to the opposite side. Listen.
Ah, woo, hang on.
start working to the opposite side to try to get those shoulders is what ideally what you want to do. And if you can't get there, you just stop your momentum, square up, take a couple breaks, and see, we're squaring up right now because we got a whole breaker across our bow. Yep. You should be good. You won't have to cover this one up. See? It's always safe. It's always better to be safe than sorry. That was breaking all the way across port and starboard. There was nowhere to go. Square up. Now we're back on it, and we're doing our outbound again. All we're trying to do is just push out. In a real-life scenario, we'd be pushing out to that person in the water. Right now, we're pushing out just for training. We have, you know, four other boats in our training area, so we're just trying to go wherever there's... Hold on. Here we go. See how nice and smooth that is? Ideally what you want to do.
Over the shoulder.
Yep. Right over the shoulder. Turn and drag that inboard engine so it sucks you back down and you don't really lose momentum going outbound. So, so now what we're doing is coming back up on range, getting in range. On range, on range, and then we'll do our inbound run again. So
we made it out.
We're outside where we want to be. We navigate to our 10 range. So we're going to sit here. Now, normally, if it was just us and another boat out there, we'd be able to pick our own series and start battling back inbound. But since there's a lot of boats out here, it takes a lot of communication to figure out who's going to go in first. And the safest, we don't want to start our lateral inbound and turn into them and then figure out that that's not what we want to do and square up and we're going to be sitting 5 yards off of them. That's ideally what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Either one, we'll push a little outside, let this boat do a lateral in, or that outside boat that's out there, we'll go first and it'll all just kind of follow in.
And then we'll be following right behind a wave.
Right behind a wave, and as you'll see, right on the peak is what you want to do. You want to see right on the edge of green water. As the wave's breaking in front of you, the bigger the better. Right as you're following it inbound, because you're trying to follow that green water. You don't want to be in the white water if you look over your shoulder right there, because that's aerated water, and our screws don't really get good suction in there, and we'll lose kind of our momentum. So you want to be on the edge of that, what they call green water, where it's breaking, and you just follow that high peak point, and you can follow an entire wave all the way in if you pick the right one.
Yeah, and that's the safest position, so the waves behind you won't break on top of
Correct.
You.
The closer you are to the wave in front of you is the furthest you are the wave behind you that's going to hurt you. Alright, this one should be fine for water. You won't get water on you. So it looks like there's a series coming in right now. I see there's a break right in front of us. There's another one, two back and three back. A nice series that's coming in. On the when you're transitioning from station keeping to doing your inbound run, you're going to want to pick the last swell usually on the series.
Uh-huh.
So that way if you find yourself not being able to keep up with that swell, you're in a nice lull where there's not a wave that's directly on behind you. If you pick that first swell on the series, you know, the group of four coming in, if you can't keep up with that wave, that second one's right behind you gaining ground on you and going to catch up. So
off of the jetty for a little bit.
So we're back at the school after having gone out on the training boat. I'm here with Aaron Barnett, also from Washington Sea Grant and co-host of Coastal Cafe. We were just kind of talking about our experience on the boat. It was pretty wild. When we were first going out there, it started out fairly calm, and I kind of saw the waves out in the distance, and there's an area called Death Row, which I was very curious of what that was going to be like, but I guess it was the area that we had to cross to then go out into the bigger ocean and then come back again. And as we first started, I definitely had a lot of adrenaline going. I was trying to navigate with new gear and keeping it dry, and it was intense. It was a lot, and especially as we did a lot of waiting in between, waiting for sets to come back and forth and waiting for the right moment to kind of go out so we wouldn't just get totally pummeled by the waves. And as we were waiting, I felt a lot of seasickness coming on. So almost between every run, I had when we were going, it was fine. And then when we stopped, I would be throwing up over the side of the boat, which just added to the adventure of it.
But it was really cool seeing the students at the, you know, helm of the boat and just navigating this wave and kind of hearing that real-time feedback of the instructors telling them what they did well, what they could do better. And there's a constant kind of dialogue. And then at the end of each run, there is a debrief, which was really cool to see in action. So, yeah, Aaron, what were your impressions being out on the boat?
Well, first of all, it was humbling. Like you were saying, we crossed Death Row into the area of the surf, which didn't look too bad from a distance. Once you get into it, it's frightening, especially when you're going head-on to 12, 16-foot waves that are cresting. The boat just about comes out completely out of the water and slams down, and then you get what spray comes over the boat. And listening to the instructors work with the students on how to negotiate the different elements of a wave, like how to hit the shoulder and how to use the throttles in conjunction with the position that they're in on the wave, was just amazing. The biggest thrill was riding this surf in towards the beach. They ride it on the back, and we're probably going 40 miles an hour at least, you know, maybe 20 knots from the boat and then another 15 to 20 from the wave. And it's exhilarating. The spray's coming over you. And the professionalism of these people is just definitely worth noting.
Yeah, there were some waves where it really was like we would come up and crest over it and then crash down. And that feeling of being weightless for a split second, it was pretty wild. And then sometimes I'm not sure if it would like crash behind us, but there would be this spray kind of coming up from over the sides. And it would just feel like kind of out of nowhere, like water just coming overboard. And yeah, it's a lot to deal with. It's like, yeah. And this is, we were kind of talking about, like, these boats can handle so much more, too. Like, as big as the surf seemed to me today, these boats sometimes go out in much bigger and much windier days. And we were lucky that we had, like, no rain today. The sun was kind of out. It's just hard to imagine when those boats are in the full force of what they're capable of.
Yeah, apparently the boats are rated for twice what we experienced, which was 12 to 16. Over 20-foot waves, 20-foot surf is what they can handle. And I think that's what the surfman rating starts at. I mean, it gives the heavy weather coxswains the ability and the certification to go out into anything.
We're back from the training here with a few of the students that I was out on the boat with. Could I ask everyone to introduce themselves?
Yeah, of course. BM2, Philip Augustino.
BM2, Frank Carpenter.
And BM2, Brian Thurman.
BM2, Cody Curls.
So how did you all feel the training went today?
Definitely some learning curves that we got to accomplish, but overall I think it was amazing training.
It was a good day. It was a lot bigger than what we've seen in this class so far, so it was a good challenge for everyone.
From my perspective, having never done anything like that before, it was pretty amazing. The waves felt really big to me. I definitely had that adrenaline surge kind of going into it, but it just gave me a lot of respect for what you guys are out there doing. It was really cool to see it in action and the expertise that is clearly involved in that. And I know that this is there's a lot of training that goes into this career path, so I'm kind of wondering, what has inspired you to follow this path?
I was at a heavy weather station prior to this and not really knew anything about surfmen. Spent a lot of time on my cutters. Driving the 47 to me was just amazing. I got to do my own thing, take my own crew out. So transitioning to another cutter, losing all of that I had, same concept, smaller boat, talking with my prior command, and which was a surfman, and told me nothing but positive things about it. So I started looking into it, and I kind of wanted to do it, so I applied for the PSP program. I've been working my way up since then.
Oh, my name is BM1 Armstrong. I'm a surfman instructor here at the National Marine Boat School. The thing that drew me to the surf was, yes, the mission. I loved like driving boats in the surf, and I think you have to follow this passion, definitely. But another thing that really inspired me was the leadership that young men and women get at surf stations. These crews are very small. These stations usually have around 25, 30 people, sometimes up range of 60 people. And as an E6 or an E5 surfman, not only are you in charge of the boat crew and the mission, but you're also in charge of a section, and that'll be up to, you know, 13, 14, 15 people, and you're doing daily operations and planning the week and planning the day of your training and all that. So it's pretty neat that the amount of responsibility that these young men and women get, and they look for you for advice and guidance, and it's a fun thing to do. It's neat.
Oh, they covered a lot of it, but another thing, too, it's kind of nice, like, starting at the bottom with that basic level and then working yourself up to that heavy weather and then eventually to that surf to the most that boat can take. So to actually get to the upper limitations of an asset is pretty amazing.
And as you're moving through those different levels to the surfman, what are the other skills that you're learning, and what does it mean to have full mastery of that boat?
It's definitely a lot, like, from basic, you're learning all the fundamentals, and then heavy weather, you're learning more with different weather. And then with surf, you're still learning every day with what comes in, with those different directions and wind. But it's a lot of responsibility, and I feel like it never ends. I keep learning every day. So you just have to pace yourself and take one thing at a time, and you'll get there eventually.
Going out there and training today, it's to hone our skills, but all this is for a reason, and the reason for that is search and rescue. So that's the biggest part about working your way up, and a lot of stuff you learn is how to apply this to different situations and make the correct decision so that you can most effectively assist someone else.
Yeah, and I imagine that doing this intensive training is really necessary so that when the stakes are really high that you'll have that practice and know what to do. I'm curious if there's any particular moments that stand out in your minds of either from today or past trainings that were just really memorable or that you learned a lot from that you'd want to share.
I think for me the biggest difference is I'm coming from the East Coast. So the conditions are vastly different. It's a lot shorter period, and the waves stack up more. So a lot of things that I could fall back on that have worked for me back home haven't worked here. So it's just every day getting my confidence up and knowing that I can go out there and do the mission and knowing that the people who trust me to be here will know that I can do the job.
The ocean is very – it's scary at all times, you know, and I feel like a good quote was you never win when you get back to the pier. You just break even. You never win over Mother Nature. And I always keep that in the back of my mind. There's a lot of times when we put the students at, we put them at a spot where we want them to fail. So they get humbled and they feel what, for one, what the boat can do. And for two, what the weather can do to you if you don't put it in the right spot. And it's a fine line as an instructor to try to let them fail, but not to the point where people get injured or, you know, we want that fear to rise up in them and then we want them to fall back to the right decision. But you don't want them to put them in too bad of a spot where everyone's at jeopardy.
So this is your third week at the school so far. So how has that experience of the last 3 weeks been and the training that you've gotten here?
Honestly, every day is different, kind of like what everybody hits on. You never know what the weather's going to throw your way. So it's just building confidence. Every day you build confidence, and every day you know, like, to trust in yourself that you can do the job. So that's the biggest thing I can take away from it.
Over the last just 3 weeks, I've seen a significant increase in, like, my boat driving, so along with our classmates as well, like their experience on the boat handler, comfortability of getting in dangerous situations and knowing the corrective actions to do and not panic. Those are things that I'm taking out of, like, what should you not do if you get into a situation? But for the school as well, like, it's probably the hardest sea school I've ever been to. It's very daunting and, like, challenging. There's, you know, a lot – we do classwork prior to, but going out there and applying those skills – with a changing environment based off the flood, you know, the ebb, you know, what is the wind doing? So applying all those skills and learning them and having your instructors there, this is by far like the best school I've ever been to and probably one of the most tired. I get out of class and I'm exhausted. I want to shower and go to bed like after the end of these classes. It really is exhausting.
It's mentally and physically exhausting. Yeah. Out there making decisions knowing that I have my, you know, you're at the helm with everybody else on the boat. So they're kind of their fate is in your hands.
I mean, these three guys would be doing, if they were back at their unit, not at this school, those last 3 weeks, they would be trying to get into the surf as much as they can, but they're trying to plan the day out, they're getting their duty sections figured out, and they're running operations. They're doing search and rescue, they're doing law enforcement, and very little of it is being selfish for themselves to, like, focus on them to get as much time in the surf as they can, and at least when they come here, they don't focus on any of that. They don't have to mess with computers. They don't have to check their email. All they do is come in, they drive a boat for, you know, hopefully 4 or 5 hours in the surf. And when they leave here, hopefully they have over 40 hours in the surf, which not a lot of surfmen can do in one winter, let alone 4 weeks. Most people probably, I would put money on it, that they don't get 40 hours of surf while they're at a unit, just them driving. It's invaluable. There's no way you can get that anywhere else.
So what will happen for you three after this course is over?
So this course does not make it to where you're a surfman when you leave. It's purely training. When you go back, you have to show your skills to your command, gain their trust. Everybody's op area is going to be different, so you got to make sure you can operate in your area of responsibility and make sure you can do that properly and efficiently. So leaving here, we'll have a lot more experience. We'll have recommendations from our instructors and the rest of the people in the class. But then also it's up to us to show our commands and our training departments that we can actually do the job in our area to gain their trust. And then once we get all that done and you have your PQS signed off, basically all your tasks signed off, then you can move into having a board and a check ride and actually getting certified. So you don't just leave here with a certification. This is giving you the ground level to make sure that you can expand on that and show your commands.
Yeah, I think importantly too, as Frank was talking about, like, earn their trust. It's not just underway. They're the officer in charge or the commanding officer of a unit has to know very well that this individual is going to make the right decisions in the worst weather. They're also going to take care of their people no matter what. So I think they look at them a lot more than just driving the boat. And it's pretty interesting to see, like, the amount of responsibility. All these people that are coming to surf school are typically the like the go-to person at their unit. They go out of their way to help, and they're training on their off day. They're always at work, it seems like. So it's a very daunting task to get this qualification.
The Creed of the Surfman.
Creed of the United States Surfman. I will, to the best of my ability, pursue each mission with the commitment, compassion, and courage inherent into the title Surfman. I will endeavor to reinforce the worldwide reputation of our forefathers in the lifeboat community.
I will maintain a guardian's eye on my crew at all times and keep a cool yet deliberate hand on the throttle. I will give of myself and my knowledge as those who gave to me, so as the line of the Coast Guard surfman will live forever. I will ensure that my supervisors rest easy with the knowledge that I am at the helm, no matter what the conditions.
I will never unnecessarily jeopardize myself, my boat, or my crew, but will do so freely to rescue those in peril. I will strive with dedication and determination to bring credit upon Coast Guard surfmen, past and future.
This is Samantha Larson, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that supports the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And, as always, a special shout-out to the band Q-Weeks for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. Thank you for listening, and have a good day.